Okay, today's session, good morning, by the way. Today's session is on validation. And before introducing the main valedictorians, I just want to say a few words. I think one of the most frustrating things is for a student or a postdoc to spend, an appreciable time of his life or her life on getting a structure, getting a density map, interpreting a structure, and then when it's all about done, somebody speaks, comes up and asks to him to defend what he has done. And this is essentially the situation that we're in. Until the time when we're all going to get atomic resolution. Then all of a sudden, once we see atoms, then nobody is going to dispute it anymore. So we still have a few years before the whole promise of the direct detection cameras really comes to fruit. And so today we're going to have Richard Henderson give an introduction into this whole subject matter, and then we have a case study by Steve Lütke, and then we have an interesting case of two doppelgangers, Bo Chen and Bo Chen, both presenting from their own research. They have been selected from posters. So with that, I'd like to give the mic to Richard.
Great pleasure. It's a great meeting, and I think we should encourage the organizers to carry on doing it as long as they can. But so validation is a sort of more. In fact, the topic of the meeting was optimization and validation. So, but today it's validation, and in some ways, it would be much better if this was just part of history. It was fully incorporated into all the procedures, and when you did the data collection and the computing, the validity of what you were doing popped out as an intrinsic part of the procedure, so you didn't have to worry about it. But at the moment, it's still a little bit of a sort of dirty word. So people might, since it's not fully incorporated into the procedures, you have to sort of add it on afterwards, and it's an extra task. And the difficulty with it is, if you do a rigorous validation, and then all that lovely work you've done turns out to be a delusion. It's a terrible disappointment. But we should be very keen on validation because it's part of the reputation of the field and your own reputation to get things right. And I just had one little story I thought I'd mention, and that was I used to work with Tom Steitz, who's done great work, but at one point in his career, he had a really good map, nothing wrong with it, but on a whim, he decided to speculate about it. And it was the cyclic AMP binding protein from E. coli. And they looked at it, and there was a groove in the surface. And he thought this looked like a left-handed BDNA groove. And it was just at the time left-handed DNA was slightly topical. So he put this in his paper to make it have more impact. But before the paper was published, it had already been disproved. So he had his great structure, and then he put something in that was basically a rash move. And then, so the whole paper was kind of discredited because it was its main claim to fame. And Tom said, that was a mistake. I'm going to have to solve 5 more structures before people start inviting me to give talks at meetings again. So, even Tom now, he realized, so your reputation and the field's reputation is important. The other fields, X-ray crystallography, NMR, they've had their hiccups, their scandals, and we remember those much more clearly than we remember the triumphs. So in EM, fortunately, we know that there are papers out there that are wrong, but fortunately there hasn't really been any big public event where, shame to the field has come in. And fortunately, I think that we've got enough tests now that probably we're just about safe. So what I was going to do today was just tell you a little bit about how we've been approaching it, show you two or three things that we've been done, sort of juxtapose it with the other things, and then hopefully, if people are convinced and do this, we'll be safe, our reputations in the field. So about 2 years ago, the 3DEM database had a meeting about 2 years ago. Kathy Lawson was organizing it because they were worried that people were depositing things and there was no proof that they were right. You know, how do you, and in the X-ray community, there's free R factors, there's lots of other tests and so on. So the conclusions of that meeting were that we needed criteria and there really weren't good enough ones. This is 2 years ago. And that developing positive tests that could prove that your map that you get is correct are still needed. And there was another aspect of it, which was to do with whether if you fit a model to your map, how do you know that model's correct? The map might be correct, but how do you know the model's correct? Could be upside down or flipped round or so on. So that was a positive recommendation. And then the best the community, and there were about 20 or 30 people, came up with that even though it wasn't a positive validation method, there were a number of things that you needed that were necessary for the map to be valid, but it wasn't this most desirable, do this, and this is necessary and sufficient to prove your map is correct. It was necessary, but it wasn't sufficient yet. So, and I'll just list those on the next slide. And then there were a few of them, few approaches that were around then that would show you, you know, whether the map is wrong. For example, you know, it bears no resemblance to anything that you were expecting to see. And there was this list of some of the... This was the EM Validation Task Force list of... This is what was suggested as a useful thing to do. One was that it was a good idea, possibly a strong recommendation, that particularly at a low resolution, a new structure that no one's done before, that you should make an effort to find the absolute hand. And that requires you either to do a tilt experiment or get to sufficient high resolution that you can see features in the map, like coil-toid helices or beta sheets and so on. And that some of the ways of finding that absolute hand were random conical tilt, different types of tilt, tomography, or this tilt pair parameter plot that I'll talk about in a significant part of the talk. And then the other discussion was, if you've got a map and it doesn't look like it has a hand, in other words, the map and its enantiomorph look more or less the same, then you haven't determined the hand. Maybe, of course, the structure is intrinsically has a sort of mirror symmetry in it. And then the question is, shouldn't you go on a bit further until your structure is good enough that you can at least tell the difference between the structure and the opposite hand? So biology is chiral. And then a sort of deeper question was, if it's a single particle structure that you've just created out of single particles, guessing the views and then getting a starting structure and then making it self-consistent, how do you know that the map you've got isn't a 50-50 mixture of the real structure and then superimposed on it an enantiomorph? Because if you get stuck into that false minimum, a wrong structure, and then you do your particle orientations and so on, half of them will go in one way, half of them will go the other way, and you don't escape from it. So that was one suggestion. And then the other one, a lot of people do this, make sure that you haven't got missing views, because that, you know, could confuse things. And then making sure that you can recognize that the raw images you have look similar to class averages if you do them, and projections from the 3D map. And again, it was thought that was necessary, but not sufficient. And often, you get a paper to a referee, or I get a paper to, or the referee is refereeing, and someone says, the projections from the 3D map show a close resemblance to the class averages and the projections. The author says that, but the referee says, I'm terribly sorry, they look completely different to me. So that's because it's subjective and it is not quantitative. And then finally, there was this idea that you should do statistical assessments of the map and look at the regions of density and the regions outside the density and so on. And then reiterated was the fact that for 10 or 15 years or so, people have known that if you divided the data into two halves and kept them completely separate, it was much harder to be deluded into believing you were doing better than you can. So this idea of the... And actually, this gold standard terminology came out of the discussion at this EM Validation Task Force meeting. And actually, Steve Lutke is my recollection. He sort of coined this name, although we now seem to be heading towards silver standards and platinum standards. And then in the meeting list of questions we should consider, the suggestion from Ron or Bridget or Clint was maybe common sense. You know, you look at it and is this reasonable? And common sense means if it's claimed to be 8 or 9 angstroms, you should see alpha helices. If it's claimed to be beyond 4.8 or 4.9 angstroms, you should see beta sheet strands that are resolved. And it's not enough to look at your map where you expect from the primary sequence that you should see, you know, 22 transmembrane alpha helices, and you think you see one. You have to see every helix and every sheet. You mustn't look around your map to find some feature that happens to coincide with it, particularly if you've then refined the map. So these were all just discussions that indicated we were still at the early stages of having kind of rigorous standards. So what I was going to talk about mainly are two things that we've worked to try and develop. And actually, this is not our main goal, is to figure out how to get better images and better structures and determine them and publish them. But along the way, we're at this stage in the evolution of the field where it's quite important that we kind of agree on and then start doing tests that validate what we're doing. So the two that I'm going to tell you about is this idea that you take tilt pairs, which people have been doing to get the absolute hand, but to do it in a more rigorous and quantitative way. We call this, we plot the parameters, the tilt angles and tilt axes, in a plot, either with one symbol per particle, or you take the data set and you plot a kind of residual or cross-correlation. And what you're looking for in this tilt pair plot is that the orientations that you determine from an image taken of the particle at one angle and another image taken, say, at 10 degrees or 20 degrees, you're looking for a cluster of orientation identifications or a minimum in the overall field of it that coincides precisely with the tilt axis and tilt angle that you set when you collected the data. But you didn't tell the program this. You kept that. That's your secret information. And unless you get that indication that the programs have determined the orientations that agree with what you put in your notebook, then that test has failed. And our rule in our lab is if it fails a test, we don't publish it. Some people think it's rather a strict test, but it is a positive test. And if it works, you know you're right at a certain resolution. And then the other one is there has been this uncertainty about resolution to do with how you calculate it and so on. So the second one is this: the idea that you should do your structure and what we've tried to do is develop a test that would be compatible with anybody's favorite way of processing it. In other words, it didn't insist that you divide the data into two halves at the beginning. It didn't insist that you terminate and not refine at high resolution. And this is that the idea you do whatever you want. You're allowed to cheat in any way that you want. You can use combinations of programs no one has ever used before and no one has ever validated. But the idea is that you then do another run right at the end where your highest resolution zone of all your particles is substituted either with noise from adjacent regions of the image, amplitudes and phases, or you just, the easiest thing, randomize the phases just in the high resolution zone where you're worried is your resolution 10 angstroms or 7 or 5 or 3 or whatever. So and I'm just going to, these are the two main things, and I'll say a couple of other things at the end. So many of you will have seen this. This was the biggest particle we tried to do this tilting test on. And this was James Chen in Nico's lab at Brandeis took these pictures. So that's a picture of a field of view of rotaviruses. And we've had this, it was published about a year ago. And this bottom picture is the same field, but it's tilted by 20 degrees, about a vertical axis. So, for example, if you look at a piece of contamination on this particle here, for example. You can see it's moved quite a bit. It's a 20-degree tilt. This one here is tilted here. And this one's only about 5 degrees. And then this is a surface shaded and a slice through the 3D model. That's from the 2008 rotavirus map. And then when you do this, so the idea is you find the orientation of that view relative to the 3D map, and then you find the orientation of that view relative to the 3D map, and then you ask what tilt axis and tilt angle relates this view to that view, and then you plot a symbol on the graph. And because there's 10 or 12 particles, you get 12 symbols. And you're expecting them to all be in the same place and all be at the angle of 20 degrees. And when you do that, and James took 10 tilt pairs here, various angles from 5 degrees to 10 degrees, and then one of them, James said it was a bit late at night, and he accidentally took it at 20 degrees because he forgot to put it. So these are then plotted, and there's about 100 particles altogether on the 10 images, maybe 10 or 12 on each one. The orientation of every particle on every image, both the untilted one and the tilted one, have come out really well. It's a big particle. There's a lot of signal. You can determine the angles really accurately. So if you take the first one, this one was tilted by... So N101 and 102, it's this little cluster here. So there's a little cluster of about 10 particles, and they're so similar in orientation. They're all on top of one another. It's about 0.2 of a degree scatter. So that's telling you that the orientations of these particles have been determined, every particle, on the first image and on the second image, to better than 0.2 degrees, so probably 0.1 or something like that. And then most of the other ones are clustered quite well as well, 0.2, 0.3, and so on. And then, not part of the talk at all, but the great surprise to us was none of these little clusters had the mean angle that was the same as the goniometer angle. This one was differing by 1.2 degrees, 0.5 degrees. Here's one that's 2 degrees different. And Axel Brillo and Nico have gone on and done a lot more. You can get... So what it's showing is that during the low-dose exposure, and that's presumably all the low-dose pictures we do, not just viruses, but small particles, Zhifeng's 20S and so on, during the picture, they're rotating as due to beam-induced damage, production of hydrogen gas. There's different theories. So they're moving, and the only one that didn't have a cluster is this one, the 20-degree one that I showed you on the last slide, where these are all from the same image, and we've colored them differently. And we asked, what were these four green ones? How did they differ from the orange particles? And it turns out the green ones are the ones near the carbon. So it looked like the carbon was helping them to not move, but further out they were moving more. Anyway, that's a sideline, but it just shows that big particles, you can get very accurate orientations. And then one of the smallest ones that we looked at, which we'd been working on for a long time, actually. So this is a picture that Sriram Subramaniam took in 1997, and we tried with Imagic, I think, but we didn't believe it, and then we tried various times with Eman. We were still not entirely convinced until about 2 years ago, with a different data set at 80 kV on film, we finally got a nice... And then this is on these new detectors that are higher resolution. But the tilt pair plot on this, using that 3D model made by Eman from these kind of images. So this was on a Cryos, but with an Eagle phosphor CCD detector, so not as good as the newer ones. There was a nice scatter about the 10-degree angle, but not now indicating an accuracy of 0.2 degrees, more like 5 or 10 degrees. Quite a lot of scatter. This is a 14-degree circle drawn round the position where we thought the goniometer should be doing it. So you're determining the orientations of the particles, but you're not determining them very accurately. And then since this, these were both in this paper a year ago, Peter Rosenthal, Peter did this original work with tilt pairs on one pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, and this is the one that was published in 2003, and we thought, we'd just publish it and then it'll be picked up by the community, but it wasn't. Nobody else, other than people who had been in our lab or had been had left the lab or were still there were doing it, or one or two people were doing it, but it hasn't been. So what Peter did was his student, Sebastian, has set up a website, and all you do is you send a stack of particles, it could be just one or 100, and the tilt pair that went with it, and the 3D model. And the website figures out the angles and does these plots. And so we sent it, that's the rotavirus, one of the rotavirus images that I showed you on the previous slide. So it's got a very sharp plot. And so this contouring is the average cross-correlation or phase residual for all the particles using the tilt angles that were obtained on the very first image. That's the one that has got less radiation damage. And then you use the second image, not as I just showed you, to find the orientations and then to compare them, but simply to plot a residual, assuming that the tilt axis and tilt angle is somewhere between plus or minus 30 degrees. And then what you're looking for is a minimum, at this case, at, I think, is it zero in this case, and nearly 10 degrees, should be nearly 10 degrees there. And then this was, so that's 50 megadaltons. Chicken anemia virus was 2.5 megadaltons. This was what Peter and I published in 2003. Pyruvate dehydrogenase, 1.6 megadaltons. So you can see that the sharpness of the orientation determination is getting worse. And then these were the two, the beta-galactosidase that I showed you, and then Phoebe Stewart's DNA-dependent protein kinase. These were the smallest, and they have the highest scatter and the least sharp minimum. But you can either, I think Steve's got tilt pairs programmed now as part of EMAN. We have programs that we can give you, but this is a website that makes it particularly easy, and we're hoping that this will just make the activation barrier for doing it less. I'll show you a couple of examples of that further on, but we were asked that by when we published this paper a year ago by the referee. It sounds remarkably similar to the question asked by the referee. And so we actually added something, and actually Peter decided this. He said that, and you'll see a table later, depending on the size of the particle, you can't expect to get 0.2 degree accuracy with a 300 kilodalton particle. So what we said was you should look at what's happened with structures of the same size, and as long as 60% of your particles were in the cluster, that was our, but it was just, that's just made up. And that the argument there was, as long as 60% of them are right, your maps, it doesn't really matter if 40% of them are sort of adding noise to the map. And I think John Rubinstein had some similar statement. Okay, so then since this, so we had a variety of molecular weights, but we had nothing between 2 megadaltons and 50 megadaltons. So we've added a couple by asking a couple of different people for specimens that were in this missing. And this is Qingfen Zhang from Zhongshan in China. She sent us this hemocyanin. I think that she's also been to Baylor and worked with Wan. They may have a paper about this. It's a nice structure, and it's about 8 megadaltons. And we've taken tilt pairs with that, and you get a nice clustering. Not every particle, but most of them are right. And then Prasad sent us a sample of Norwalk virus, which is about 10 megadaltons. And I'll tell you, this is one of the examples I'll show a bit later on. When we first did it, it didn't work at all. And it turned out that the X-ray map, which we were using as the search model, there's something funny, something different about the X-ray map, and then we had to make our own map in the end to get this reasonably sharp peak, and that was a 5-degree tilt pair. So on this table, then, we have this, what you might expect if the particles that you're working on have a molecular weight from 50 megadaltons, 10, 8, 7, 2, 1, etc., down to about half a megadalton. And we haven't tried on anything smaller than this, but it would be a very good positive proof that you've got your orientations right and your structures right if you were to go for smaller particles here. And it didn't see, there didn't seem to be any correlation with symmetry, and that's what we expect. We expect the signal in the images to be proportional to the amount of matter in the particle, and that's what's giving your orientations. The difference between a highly symmetrical icosahedral and something without any symmetry is that you simply have to search a much bigger region of orientational space, but the signal should still be there. And then the angular accuracy on the other end varies from being very sharp from these big particles, more or less, and there's no real deviation from the fact that, so these particles are 100 times less mass than this particle, and it's roughly, it's not quite 100 times more accurate, but it's maybe 50 times more accurate here than here. And obviously, the better you make your images, you get new detectors, you get less motion, you remove the motion from the movies, these angles will get better. And we had a table, which I'm not going to show you, is you can translate angular uncertainty into a blurring of your object. And actually, with angles like this, you can never get to three angstrom resolution. You need to get them down, not far, actually. You need to get them down to 2 or 3 degrees. And so for small particles, we think that the fact that you put the beam on and you get beam-induced motion and things rotate, that rotation doesn't really matter for small particles. And for big particles, obviously people have published 3.3 angstrom maps, 3.8 angstrom maps for big particles. Usually when you have beam-induced movement or rotations, it is about one axis, and the movement is in one direction. So within a data set, there will be some particles that have some directions that go all the way out. And probably that's where your high-resolution data comes from. And the rest, and that's why you need so many particles compared to what, in principle, you'd get if there was no particle movement and perfect DQE and so on. Okay, so a couple of things now about what else is this tilt pair parameter plot useful for. So one of them is to tell you what resolution of information in your data set is needed to give you the good orientations. And these were three of them, just meant to be a big particle, a medium particle, and a small particle. And so what we did was, inside Nico's program FreeAlign, where we're determining the orientations, we vary the low resolution and the high resolution cutoff and ask how many of the particles get correctly aligned when we vary that. So this is about 20 runs. And what it shows is that you only need, in this rotavirus, you can get more or less perfect alignments using the data from about 120 angstroms. This is 25, that's 50, 70 angstroms. So you can get orientations within about half a degree using rotavirus data that goes to 60 or 70 angstrom resolution. That's because it's greatly overdetermined. Of course, if you go out, you'll get them a little bit more accurate, but it didn't seem to matter because this was a 2-degree circle that we were using. And then even on these smaller particles, the resolution that you're using, so beta-galactosidase, we found that there's a little improvement as you go out. So this is 25 angstroms, this is 12 angstroms, there's a little improvement. Most of it comes in this range, say 100 angstroms to 20 angstroms. And in the talk that Shores gave, where he's got a more analytical expression for where the orientability comes from, he had a big effect, 20 angstroms, and then by 10 angstroms it was beginning to fade. There's still data there, but it's a very small contribution. Yeah?
Won't that depend on how you acquire the images and if you've used a better detector with higher
exactly, degree, higher exactly, resolution? Yeah. So one day, so these are the best images that we were able to take, and most of them are on film. So they'll be a bit blurry and so on. And I'll show you one example where we think it's a challenge, actually, for people. Apoferritin, which I think Holger talked about as well. So we can't get that one to orient, but we've modeled it, but I'll show you. Okay, so here is two examples, then, that what you get if it doesn't work. So this was that Norwalk virus that we got. We took perfectly good images, and we tried to do it using 10 or 15 angstrom model from the X-ray coordinates. And this was the orientations of 50 particles, and then on the tilt pair, and it didn't work. So we worked hard, we ran multiple plots, we varied the resolution, trying to find that sort of sweet spot to try and get better. And it, you know, it looked like maybe it was, this was a 5-degree tilt, this is a 10, 20, 30 degree. It looked like maybe there was a cluster, but it wasn't on one side, it was on both sides. So after this not successful run, we decided to take some more pictures, try harder, and we did it again. But instead of doing it on film, we did it on a CCD and so on. So the tilt axis here was vertical. The tilt axis here is horizontal. And then it was completely clear that you've got a cluster around the right direction, but you've got another cluster, almost the same number, very similar to this, in the other direction. So we said, well, you know, this shows that our model is unable to distinguish between the orientation of a particle and then the orientation of a particle with the opposite hand. So this would be, and it turned, and so one suggestion was maybe the model, which was downloaded from the PDB, it was a 15-year-old structure that Prasad had done, and he didn't have the 3D map. So we just took the particles that were in these data sets and made our own new model from the EM. And then when we ran it, all of these ones moved over to there. And then we fiddled with it a bit more, and even the particles in different areas of the same micrograph, I think this is just one micrograph actually, you can see that, that some of the green, orange, and black are from different regions of the micrograph. You can just about begin to see the same kind of beam-induced rotation motions in this particle as we saw on the bigger particle before. So that's an example of where it didn't work, and it didn't work in this case not because the images were bad, but because the model was bad. And on the previous slide, if you look at the, it did it, didn't it? So that was the X-ray model that we downloaded from the PDB, and that was the map that we created from similar images to this. And you know, you can see, we don't understand what's different. Something's different. It wasn't proteolysis. Something's moved. Mass has moved such that the X-ray map resembled the EM map. And the opposite hand of the EM map equally well. So this tilt pair test is not only a test of the quality of your images, but a quality of your 3D model, and you can use it in various ways. Okay, so let's go. So one other example is apoferritin, same size as beta-galactosidae. It's 450 megadaltons. It's got 4-3-2 symmetry, and it was solved in 1978 by Pauline Harrison. There's dozens of 2-angstrom or better apoferritin structures in the database. And the top one are real images now taken on our back-thin Falcon. We were hoping that it would work. Xiaoxia Chen took these. And when we did, using that map as the search and these images, this was the tilt pair parameter plot that we got. There's absolutely no sign whatsoever that we've been able to determine the orientations of any of the particles. And we thought this must be due to the fact that this is basically a hollow sphere, and the sphere is 20 angstroms thick, and it's empty in the middle, there's no iron in it, it's apoferritin. And in order to get orientations, you have to get good, sharp images that are at 10 angstroms, which is the alpha helix spacing. And that the data out to 20 angstroms or 15 angstroms is not necessarily going to help you. So Greg McMullen created these fake images, trying his very best to make them look identical. And so these images are images of these particles, but they've had an MTF, a DQE, and the noise color power spectrum of the real images made to be very much the same. And so with these fake images, we can then ask, well, is there some problem with the programs and so on? And there isn't. So this is the tilt pair parameter plot from fake tilt pair images, but from a real structure. And it works well with, if you put a B factor of 100, it works well with a B factor of 200 on the data. But by the time you've blurred it to be 300, 400, you've lost it. So what that's saying is that these images are not good enough to find the orientations, and that we need to improve the quality of them so that the data at 10 angstroms is good enough to get the real orientation. So at the moment, we are hopeful that with trying harder and using different exposures, These were all done with 15 electrons per square angstrom. And it turns out that the data at 10 angstroms at 300 kV fades to about half. The 10 angstrom Fourier components, following the talk that John Rubinstein gave, fades to about half of the intensity that you started with, or the amplitude you started with, at 12 electrons per square angstrom. So our idea now is you should do the tilt pair, one image at 12 electrons per square angstrom, and the next one at maybe 50, so that you get roughly equal power in each image. And
the resolution wasn't truncated in this. It was, they were all the same. Theoretically, you go out to high resolution.
Yeah, These were, well, we went to 6 angstroms or something. We digitized it 3 angstrom pixels. And these were all done on the same pixel size. Everything was supposed to be the same. But the thing that you can do now, then, is you can ask, in these fake simulated images, quite lifelike, Greg was congratulated by some people on how well he'd been able to fake them. You can do the same resolution test, and it turns out that this is a different scale now. So it turns out you basically need, to get them oriented, you need the data at 10 angstroms, but maybe 20 angstroms to 10 angstroms, rather than 100 to 20 in some of these other structures, which have more of an envelope, more grooves in them, more things that at low resolution tell you the orientation. Whereas apoferritin has this hollow sphere, and you have to have this data at higher resolution to get it. So that remains a challenge, and I think Holger reckoned he got some indication from class sums that the orientations possibly were being determined, but I think this, if the tilt pair test doesn't work, you haven't got the orientations. And there's one little caveat, and that is, when you do the tilt pair, of course, you're putting half of your dose on one image and then leaving something left and then doing the other half on the other image. You could argue that if you put it all into one image and blast it so that you've got all that, all those wonderful Fourier components in the image, you've got twice the signal in one image. So again, some people argue that this tilt pair test is a bit too tough, a bit too stringent, because you're only using half the data. But our view is that if you've got 120 particles, surely one or two of them should show up correctly, even with half the dose. Because as Bob said, the singleton noise, you know, is 2.9 NE is where you get the maximum, 2.5 or 2.9. If you're down at 1, it's not a lot different in terms of singleton noise. Yeah?
This assumes that you have a program that is capable of aligning each particle to the model, and that is the perfect ability. If you envision another method, another mathematical method to actually align the particles to each other, that is better than this program.
Correct. We'd love that.
But you will say, from somebody who produces a map from that actually that map is not right.
No. To make a map, you have to know the orientation of each image. And how you find it is your own problem. And if there's a better algorithm, fantastic.
But then I submit the map, and I submit the particles, and your algorithm doesn't perform as well. And then how can I use your algorithm as a measure?
This is a test that requires more data that's not in the map. It requires you to take specifically a tilt pair.
Definitely. I take a tilt pair of the same quality of data.
Yeah.
Okay? And I submit the test set. Yeah. I submit my model. But your algorithm is incapable of achieving the same level of alignment that my algorithm is using.
Yeah.
And therefore, your algorithm is a wrong measure.
No, but you can...
I can submit the algorithm as well.
He's talking about the web page.
Where he relies on Sebastian to align some of the images. That's...
Who is Sebastian?
So you can also do the alignment yourself and just submit the orientations for the tilt pairs and then use the algorithm.
Yeah, you're allowed to use any program or any algorithm that you want to find the angle. The only thing that is you're taking the two angles and you do the plot. So the only all that I've done differently, we wrote a little program called Tilt Diff, reads in the orientations and makes the plot. Okay. And Peter wrote a program that reads in one orientation from the first image, the one that has least damage, and then does a residual against the whole pile of the second images. And this, Peter's way, is on the web server. And this way, you know, there's a little program, but other people have written tilt pair programs. Shores has written one. Steve Lutke has written one. So, you know, this is just a procedure that anybody can do with their own software to get the angle. So it's, I think it's a sort of general thing, but it is tough. So
yeah, what would be to me is that the operator actually is can be your own operator.
Yeah, exactly. And I've tried quite hard to get some people to do this when there's a slightly flaky, and there is a certain reluctance, I should say, because there is this worry. And one of the best comments was, I think this is a really good thing to do. Should I do this test before or after I submit my paper? And virtually always we've concluded it'd be better to do it after. Okay, so then the second thing, which isn't so complicated, is once you've done tilt-pair and you know it basically that you've got it right, but from that resolution plot, all it's doing is validating you to 20 angstroms or 15 angstroms or 10 angstroms. It doesn't tell you whether you've got 8 angstrom or 5 angstrom or 3 angstrom data because you don't need that to get the orientations. In fact, the contribution to the orientation from that high resolution data is quite small. So in terms of resolution, what people have been doing up to now, and they've known this, but it's not popular. Neither of them have been very popular. One of them, which Shores had explained really well, and actually Nico, I think, was the one in 2000 who first said that if you process the data homogeneously and use the same model to find the particles and then split it at the end, you must build up some degree of overfitting. The noise goes into the model. The noise then influences the orientations even a little bit. But if you divide the data into two halves and keep them entirely separate all the way from the beginning, then they go their own way, and you can't, since the data never saw one another, you can't build up any correlation between the data, and that's this idea of having gold standard Fourier shell correlation. And this is sort of intrinsically, there's an intuitive emotional feeling that somehow or other you're not allowing yourself to be as successful as you would be if you allowed all the data to make a better model and get you better orientations and a better structure. So there is this entirely intellectual, rational argument that dividing the data into two halves might be something that is handicapping what you might otherwise achieve. So that's been not so popular. Another one, which people who've been using FreeAlign have known for a long time, because it's got a very explicit, you put the two resolutions in, and inside the program, it only looks at, in reciprocal space, it only looks at the pixels that are inside that resolution range. So if you put in 10 angstroms as your cutoff, the data beyond 10 angstroms isn't even looked at until later on when you do the comparison. So it's also essentially a completely independent test. So you have this low-pass cutoff or filtered data, 10 angstroms or 50 angstroms, and then the data beyond that, when you do your Fourier shell correlation, cannot be contaminated by fitting because you've never used it. And this is also not so popular because people feel, well, all that data out there that I know is there at 7 angstroms or 5 angstroms and so on, it must be helping my orientations. And if I put it in, it'll make it better. And of course, when you put it in, it does make it better. The only problem is you have no idea if it's real or overfitted noise. So these exist, and people know that they should be doing this, and they know it's good. But and even Yifeng, who has a great map, and you know it's obviously correct. You can look at the atoms. When we had a discussion after the talk, he said, "Oh yes, we only use it to 6 angstroms, but we've been ever so tempted to just do a little bit more." So and what it does, it makes your data look better, and it might be true. But you don't know. So the idea then was to think of some way of processing your data that would allow you to do anything you want, and therefore you wouldn't be worried that you weren't giving yourself the best possible chance. And that is that you just go ahead and do anything you want, including tweaking the parameters to get your absolutely best Fourier shell correlation. But having done that, so you perform your single particle analysis by any procedure, but then you take your starting data set of particles and either put in amplitudes and phases from an adjacent region of the micrograph, which retains the same power, the same interpixel correlation. Almost all the properties of that data set are the same, except you know that beyond this selected resolution, there cannot possibly be any signal because you've got rid of it. And we've called this high-resolution noise, and it turns out there's really no difference between doing that rather rigorous thing, which involves you picking lots of empty spaces, equal number of particles, or just randomizing the phases beyond a certain resolution. You can't find any difference. And then you just do the structure again, and then you do Fourier shell correlation from the particles, and you shoot Fourier shell correlation from this high-resolution noise substituted particles, and you compare the two Fourier shell correlation curves. Any overfitted noise shows up as a non-zero FSC in the high-resolution noise curve, and the real information from the structure is the area between the two curves. So you're allowed to do anything you want. You just do this little test at the end, and then you're either, you know, happy or unhappy, depending on how it turns out. So this is an example. This is a picture of these beta galactosidase, 450 kilodalton particles. The top row here are 10 particles that have been picked out. The bottom row are 10 regions of background in between the particles. And then these four in between, which you will not be able to see any difference at all by eye. The second and third row have had all the Fourier components beyond 10 angstroms. In the first one, substituted by the Fourier components from this picture. In the second one, the phases have been randomized. You can't see any difference. And here, it's beyond 17 angstroms. And if you look very carefully, there are some little features that look slightly blurrier, because it does it, you know, even if it's a piece of dirt or a little white, they will be blurred as well. And then just for interest, and I'll come back to this at the end, we did a plot of the power spectrum of 3,000 particles and a plot of the power spectrum of 3,000 noise regions from the absolutely adjacent part of the micrographs. And here is the resolution out to 3 angstroms, and this is the amplitude of the Fourier components. And the little red dots are the 3,200 particles coming down. And the little blue dots are the 3,200 particles of background. And there is junk in it, you know, degraded polypeptides and so on and so on. So actually, if you look at the images, there are tone rings in this, which we don't think comes from ice. We think it comes from junk in, you know, that's not part of the particles. But if you subtract those two curves, you can see the red. It's sort of red on the top and blue on the bottom. So the particles are always stronger than the background, but not by much. So you, by the time you're at 3 angstroms, the signal is much smaller by something like, that's intensity, actually. It's a power spectrum. So it's like a factor of 10 or 20 in amplitude below the particles. And that's just, we'll come back to that later on. But for this test, we're just going to do particles versus particles substituted with high-resolution noise. And I'm just going to show you a few of these to show you what they look like. So this was an older data set taken on film, wasn't so good as on these new detectors. And the red dots are the normal procedure. But in order to show that how this overfitting shows up, we've refined it using Friedlein out to 7 angstrom resolution, which is out to about here. And so you get the red curve, and then you do it with the high-resolution noise data set, 17 angstroms, comes down. And the blue, so the blue is overfitted noise, and the pink is the real structure. So it's not too bad. It doesn't affect it. But basically, all the high-resolution stuff beyond about 12 angstroms is all noise. And between 12 angstroms and 17 angstroms, it's about a third or a half of it is overfitted. So it gives you a quantitative measure of how much overfitting you've got. And from the difference between the two curves, we do this 0.143 thing, and it turns out it's about 12 or 13 angstroms. And that wasn't very many particles. We did it again with 50,000, and it got a little bit better. If you then do what we've been doing for many years, only refine the data to 17 angstroms, then you don't get any overfitting, and there's not really a lot of difference in terms of the quality of the map. So no overfitting by terminating the refinement at 7 angstroms, and a perfectly nice and very much the same resolution. And the way you can be convinced, and Shores showed this, I think, with the ribosome data set, you can compare this structure refined only to 17 angstroms with this structure refined to 7 angstroms in terms of the orientations, with an atomic model, and they're basically the same. So that just says that the power in the particles is very small. This is the overfitted noise. Obviously, whether you've got it overfitted or not, it won't agree with the model. And then the two data sets, whatever resolution, they're very much the same. So if we then go on to some new data, so this is on the same plot. This is some data on this back then Falcon, 40,000 particles. And this curve tells you quite a lot. So we have it 2x2 binned, so that actually our resolution is only 6.5 angstroms or so at Nyquist. So it goes to zero beyond that because of the sampling. And at the moment, we've now got this same job running without doing binning, and it'll go out a bit further. So it's basically a structure that's a bit better than 7 angstroms. Again, the high-resolution noise test, substituting the data beyond 10 angstroms with randomized phases, gives you... And actually, in order to show this up nicely, I had to cheat a little bit with FreeAlign. So there is this RB factor parameter. You're allowed to sharpen your high-resolution data a bit. And obviously, you know, EMAN has high-pass filter and so on. There's this in all of the procedures. You can give a bit more weight to the high resolution. So the blue is the amount of overfitting, which as you get towards the highest resolution, where the noise is much bigger than the signal, you get more overfitting, and the pink is the real structure. And again, if you don't refine, if you don't use the data beyond 10 angstroms to determine the orientations, you get the green curve. And it might be that the red one, after you take this into account, might be ever so slightly better than the green one. I'm not going to go into that at the moment. But that's an example of you just do this test, you get this plot, and you immediately feel relaxed and happy. You know your data is good, and you know how much overfitting that you've got, and you don't need to worry about it anymore. So then Shores ran the same data set both with RELION and with XMIP, using the two procedures he talked about yesterday. So the way that this gold standard Fourier shell weighting works inside, in this case, RELION, is that at each cycle, you've divided the data into two halves. So if you've got random noise at high resolution, the gold standard Fourier shell correlation looks at data that's never seen itself. The correlation is zero, and so the weight goes in to the next cycle as zero. So you get absolutely no overfitting at all. Whereas in the real data, you have, you know, it goes in with... And then, so you get now... And obviously, you won't need to do this again because you've done it once, but this gives a really nice map, and actually it is the best resolution and the least overfitting. And the other way of doing it... So here is where you use the Fourier shell correlation of the particles with one map. So everything goes into one map, and you do a Fourier shell correlation between the two halves, but they're not two completely independent halves. So the map gradually builds up a bit of overfitting in it, and the Fourier shell correlation curve, which is what most people have been doing, so-called conventional, or what was Shor's word for it?
Suboptimal
Fourier shell correlation. You put more weight than you should on the high resolution because the high resolution part of the map has a bit of overfitting in it. And that then allows it to build up on itself. And so here, again, in blue is the pure overfitted part of the structure, and in the pink is the bit of the high resolution structure that's real. And again, so beyond about 6.5 or 7 angstroms, it's all overfitted. And below that, it's about half. And here, it's probably about a third. So it gives you a quantitative measure of your resolution and a quantitative measure of the proportion of the features at high resolution that represent overfitted noise and the proportion that's real. Okay, so that's the two main things. So these are two validation tests. You know, I've thought about it, tried to think about it quite a lot. I think if you do these two tests and they both work, they tell you that your structure is correct and validate it to exactly the right resolution. So this was our summary. Tilt pair parameter plots proves that the orientations that go in correct, and provided you've done everything else, like, you know, defocus, magnification, and so on, the map must be correct. But since the tilt determination usually only involves lower resolution Fourier components, it doesn't tell you that you're at high resolution. And that was where this other idea came in. High resolution noise in the very, very weak part of the structure validates that. And you can get one to work without the other, or the other to work without the one. And I think you need to have both if you're going to claim a certain resolution and claim it's right. So, for example, that apoferritin map that I showed you, or the attempt to get orientations, it failed on the tilt pair parameter test. But a hollow sphere without any orientation has Fourier components that go out to 6 or 7 angstroms. So if you take the orientations that you get with the apoferritin, calculate a 3D map, and then divide it into two halves, or terminate the resolution, you will find that there is correlation beyond that resolution, which comes from the part of the structure that doesn't need you to have the orientation. So depending on the structure, it can fail the tilt test, but apparently give you real data. And it is real data, it's just that it's a little bit of the real data and not the whole structure. And similarly, of course, you can have the tilt pair test work, but have nothing beyond 10 angstroms. So this next slide, then, is our current view on what would be a really nice way to end a paper about a new structure that you didn't know before. Obviously, you can't do atomic models with it, but the bottom two, this is a tilt pair plot, parameter plot. It requires you to take a bit of extra data. This one doesn't require you to take any extra data, but you have to make an extra run with randomized high-resolution phases. And we have one little program that reads in the stack, writes out another stack, but I'm sure lots of people can do this. And then the top two, you know, once these have worked and you're starting to claim that your map can now be interpreted in terms of atoms, then I think you're obliged to show how well those atoms agree with it, not just say, look how nice it is, this bit of the map. You know, and you pick out 5 regions from, you know, 1,000 amino acids. So this is a superposition of the X-ray coordinates of beta-galactosidase with this 6 or 7, 6.5 or 7 angstrom map. And what we look at are, these are Bridget and Ron's comment. There are 2 little helices, 2 turns and 3 turns, that are reasonably well resolved, and then there's a little beta hairpin that sticks out here. And you can see this at lower resolution, but it gets nicer and sharper. So that's a visual superposition, and you can look at bits of it. But this right-hand one now is a Fourier shell correlation between a map created from the atoms and the experimental map. And the general idea here is that in the Fourier shell correlation between the two halves of the data, that provided they haven't been looked at, or provided you're looking at the difference between those two curves, and it's not actually linear, so this 0.143 doesn't work quite, but you can make up a formula that tells you the resolution here should agree with, if it's a model that is purported to interpret the map, the 50% correlation between the model, which shouldn't really have data if you've got a model. So the 50% point here should be at the same resolution. This is map versus the model versus the... And it isn't in this structure, it isn't quite right, because all we've done with the coordinates, we only allowed one parameter, which was the magnification. We haven't done ever so slight rotations such that the subunits or subunit domains might be allowed. So we think that once that's taken into account, this is about 7.2 or something like that. We think it'll be the same, 6.5 or 7. Okay, so those were the two main things that I wanted to mention. 2 tests plus a Fourier shell between map and model. But then I wanted to just end by saying that if you're doing these things, there are other things that you can learn from the data that are quite interesting. And actually, Zhifeng showed his very last slide in his talk on Tuesday. So he's done something similar. So the idea is, we've done our map, we've collected the data, we've got our tilt pairs, we've validated the resolution, we've published it, but how well have we done in terms of judging whether the images could be improved with more effort, better detectors, you know, did they blur and so on? Are the images as good as they should be? Is the map as good as it should be, given the images that have gone into it? And what is missing and why? And that requires you to do quantitative analysis of the data and the maps and compare them to what you're trying to get. And as I try to say, this is trying to do quantitative single particle EM. And we used to do this with 2D crystals. We were always comparing image amplitudes to diffraction amplitudes and so on, and trying to say, well, you know, we must do better. And and of course, to do better, you have to change something. You can't just try again. And the three things that seem to be is detector DQE, and obviously we've got a big step forward, and one good question is it still perfect or going to be greatly improved? We know that there's beam-induced movement, and again, you can remove part of this by processing the movies. And then there is the possibility that specimen charging is somehow, according to a mechanism that's not been agreed, might be blurring the images. So this last slide that I wanted to show you is, that's the same one I showed you before. That's the power spectra of 3,000 particles and the power spectrum of 3,000 backgrounds and the difference between them. And if you then compare that to an atomic model, the red is an atomic model for beta oxide downloaded from the X-ray, with as good an effort as we can to make it solvent corrected. That is the radial resolution against the natural log of the amplitude. The red is what we ought to get one day once we've got our method to be working perfectly. That means perfect DQE, DQE is no movement, no charging. The blue is the best map that we've got so far, which is from Relion. And if you look here, the difference between the model and the map at 6.5 angstroms is something like 2, 4, 6 natural log units. So that's like a factor of 200 or something like that. So we can still, we hope, make a big difference. And then the green is the raw power in the images. So, and now both of these curves, both the raw power in the images and in the 3D model, this is what we've extracted from the data. These are the images, this is the map. Both of these should be corrected for the effects of the MTF of the detector, and some detectors have a better MTF than others. And then Nico talked about on the first day, the high-resolution Fourier components fade more rapidly than the low-resolution one, and there's a B factor associated with radiation damage of 70 or 80 or something like that. So both of these should be brought up. And even taking account of those, we're missing quite a big factor. And also, this green curve doesn't come down as steeply as the blue curve. So what I think this shows is that there is data in the images that we're not extracting properly, and probably we're not extracting it because the orientational accuracy that we get from the quality of the images that we have isn't quite good enough. So there's a blurring effect which creates an extra fading from lack of orientational accuracy, even though there is power in the images. And of course, if you make the images better and you get power at high resolution, your orientations will get better. And so better images are the answer to making this come higher. And eventually, you know, we ought to get them to be perfect and then get really high resolution. There could be other explanations for this. For example, this is just the power in the particles. And once you've blasted them, so that the atoms are still there, but they're not having the same Fourier power, it could be that some of this power is radiation damage. So it remains to be seen where that all comes from. Anyway, fortunately, Affini.
I missed how the green. How did you get the raw amplitudes of the power of the particles? Are you subtracting the?
Could we just start the discussion now? Okay. All right. So this is the first question.
Oh, you're okay. Yeah, that was the last slide.